ever wanted to learn more about the effects of blowing stuff up, shooting high speed, and creating practical effects? Well, FX PhD and 3210 Studios are offering a unique chance to learn this from multiple Oscar nominees in a three-day hands-on workshop. The workshop is going to be held from September 29th to October 1st and be taught at the 3210 Studios, the old ILM model shop in San Rafael. For more information and for pricing, check it out at fxguide.com or fxphd.com. Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we're actually, pivoting to television, to episodic visual effects, because we wanted to look at the film, or rather the film. See, I'm already doing it. I wanted to look at the TV show Falling Skies, and we wanted to do it for two reasons. One, we enjoy the show. It's great sci-fi. And secondly, it brings into sharp relief the incredible growth in visual effects in episodic television and the challenge that they face to an audience that's incredibly literate with feature film. Do we have to make apologies for visual effects? I mean, let's face it, a lot of people grew up with effects in TV shows that were a bit ropey, and we still love them to death. So to find out whether or not we can truly love a lower-budget visual effect on a much, much grander scale, I'm joined by, firstly, Matt. Matt Wallen, how are you?
I'm great. Yeah, happy to be here to discuss this topic in particular. I think this is definitely a super exciting time in television in particular for a lot of reasons.
And we also got Ian Fales. Ian, how are you?
Good, Mike. How are you doing?
Good. You haven't been on for a little while. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Looking forward to it.
So, you know what I'm saying about episodic television? In a traditional sense, we used to cut it a lot of slack. Because, you know, we expected the television stuff not to be as good as the feature film stuff. Though I will point out, historically speaking, visual effects in television went digital much earlier than visual effects in films, which is a really interesting aspect, Matt. So, for example, The Next Generation, Star Trek The Next Generation, did an enormous amount to pioneer workflows that would then filter into ILM and digital domain as places for doing large-scale visual effects.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's totally true. And I think with respect to television visual effects, I was a big fan as a kid of, which, you know, kind of shows my age, I guess, but the original Battlestar Galactica when it was on television, and they had John Dykstra. They got into a bunch of legal trouble with Lucasfilm, too, but they had John Dykstra as the visual effects supervisor on what was originally the Battlestar Galactica movie. Where they did a bunch of shots using traditional motion control and blue screen and stuff with miniatures for the original Battlestar Galactica movie, which became the Battlestar Galactica TV show. And John Dykstra, who had been the visual effects supervisor on the original Star Wars movie, did all the work on that show. And so as a kid, you know, it was always really exciting. Anytime there was a television show, they went on later and they did a Buck Rogers in the 25th century with Gil Gerard and Aaron Gray, I think, and the little tweaky robot and stuff. And it had also some miniature blue screen motion control visual effects. And what they often did in those shows was they would take the visual effects that they generated and they would just repurpose them and they would flip them around. And, you know, as a kid, you were sort of didn't really notice that. Or if you noticed it, you know, you didn't really care because you were just so happy to have something on, you know, broadcast television that was of, you know, some quality science fiction, especially if you were a kid who grew up, you know, with the original Star Wars and stuff, which is what I think these things really took off on in general. And then you're right, when they started to do the Star Trek Next Generation, some of it was done with traditional effects, but then they really did make a huge push into doing a lot of the work digitally, which did bleed over into films. But one thing I was going to mention too, just if I might, just about TV in general, I think we're right now, you know, with shows like this Falling Skies, but then you look at, you know, there's some great visual effects. And I think FX Guide did a story on in Breaking Bad, one of the season finales where one of the big bad guys is killed. But there are so many great shows right now on television that incorporate visual effects. We really are, I think, in a golden age of TV. There's, you know, even looking at on HBO, there was the show what's the Boardwalk Empire, and so many great set extensions and stuff that were done by, I think, Brainstorm Digital in New York, and just phenomenal, fantastic work. And I think we could talk about, you know, maybe some of the shortcomings that would come about with regards to working in television with abbreviated schedules and such. But I do think you're now looking at television, and in television you're seeing what you don't see as much as maybe you saw in the 1980s and 90s in independent film. And a lot of what's happening on the quote-unquote small screen is filling some of those more niche audiences, and you're getting great programs like this Falling Skies show, which I actually hadn't watched any of until the idea came up to do this show.
I was going to agree with you, Matt, that these days this visual effects is on TV is so wide now. You know, it's not just the domain of sci-fi. Of course, Falling Skies and Terra Nova, which we also covered, is pretty amazing, and Walking Dead, but then there's also Boardwalk Empire and Breaking Bad and another TV show, Hemingway and Gilhorn, which, you know, just have just as much effects, really, as some of the big films. And even the Emmys this year now have two categories. There's an outstanding special effects category and an outstanding special effects in a supporting role category.
Actually, that's what I was going to mention, because if we go back to that period around Star Wars, there was things like Space 1999.
Oh, right.
There were good sci-fi shows back in the day, but when you had visual effects in those sorts of shows, Battlestar Galactica, the original series, albeit me, I just had really blotted that out, and Space 999. But the thing about that stuff is it was deliberately sci-fi type stuff, right? The original Star Trek, the original shows that we've been talking about, very obviously the case. And you've hit on it there, Ian, that there's now this huge growth in both areas. You've got the deliberate stuff that's either fantasy or sci-fi, because I think another show that we need to mention is Once Upon a Time, a large case of doing digital backlot. You know, lots of the scenes of that film or that show are shot on a green screen stage where everything's put in digitally in post. An incredible production schedule. But obviously, you know, we know that, you know, it's got witches and, you know, storybook characters. And so clearly we're in that zone, which I'd put in the same thing as this show, where it's very obvious it must be a visual effects. And then you've got all that transparent stuff that's going on in those things. Even though I guess you know it's probably the case in Boardwalk Empire and stuff, it's still much more grounded in a kind of a realistic, non-sci-fi, non-fantasy genre where you want those effects to be as invisible as possible. Just give us a rundown on who's up in the Emmy categories and what they are.
Just right. Yeah. Both. So in the first category, which is Outstanding Special Visual Effects, you've got Falling Skies, and that's work by Zoic, and we're going to talk about that today. Then there's Game of Thrones, work by Pixamondo, a show called Inside the Human Body, which was done by Jellyfish in London. Then Once About a Time, that's again a Zoic one. Pan Am, the pilot, was done by Stargate Digital. And they also worked on The Walking Dead, which is another one up for nomination. Then there's another category, which is the Outstanding Special Visual Effects in a Supporting Role. And that's the domain of Boardwalk Empire. And Matt, you mentioned that was Brainstorm Digital. Then Bones from Look FX, The Borgias by Spin, Breaking Bad, which had work by Velocity VFX and Greg Nicotero. Then Hemingway and Gilhorn had Tippett Studio working on their shots, and another pilot for Touch was done by Stargate Studios.
And of course, very much, you touched on it there, very much one of the big players in this, which we should have mentioned, I guess, right out of the gate, is that fantasy phenomenon, I guess is probably the way to describe it. You know what I'm alluding to, and I haven't even said the words yet, right? Because Game of Thrones has probably, you know, been as big a success for HBO as anything recently, and it's certainly built over time. But there are some key companies you mentioned there. I should also point out that I think Stargate Digital did the pilot for Pan Am, but I don't think they went on to do the actual episodic work when the series went into full production. Is that right, Ian?
That's right. Yeah.
But Stargate Digital and Zoic are probably, I think we'd agree, the two biggest names that come up the most doing this kind of work. They are companies that have incredibly, incredibly complicated pipelines. And I want to just touch on that before we get back to doing Falling Skies, because the thing about the pipeline that we have to remember is that this isn't a case of, in a feature film where you sort of either have a company or you put a company together, you get the script, you break it down, you shoot, you come out of principal photography, you hand over the shots, you do the effects, and then it finishes, and there's the director as the driving force. When you're doing episodic television, and I've done my fair share of it, in fact, I was nominated for an Emmy for episodic television, it's an overlapping series problem. It's an overlapping episode problem. So what happens is you have a director on one ep, and you have a different director on another ep. So it tends to be the series producer that's driving it, not so much the director in terms of providing a visual consistency and also a narrative plot arc. And of course, the showrunner isn't normally the director of the episodes, and that's the sort of the head of the whole shooting match. But then the other thing you've got is you may have seven eps in simultaneous production. And the amount of visual effects shots in a show like Once Upon a Time or something like Falling Sky, it's if you don't have your data workflow, your metadata workflow, and your actual production scheduling workflows are really super tight, you're just never going to meet the deadlines. You're never going to deliver the shots that you need to do. And it's crushing. And the last show I did, which was one for Britain, I think we did about 162 shots in 30 days. And you know, that's the kind of take we're doing. So I have a special love of this stuff and a huge respect for the teams that are doing the work they're doing. And so a lot of the stuff, like I know, for example, from talking to the guys at Zoic, you know, involves having massive amounts of calibration on set. So you know exactly where cameras are. You have to have a lot of stuff automated into the pipeline. So there is an extra dimension that is just as valid as any what we might call individual artist craft, which was what we sort of normally focus on in this episodic stuff. It's obviously there in feature film. You obviously have to have a very tight pipeline in feature film, and that's, you know, 2,000 shots. But you don't have that sort of concept of I've got seven stories running at once.
Yeah, well, and I was just going to say, too, like with regards to television, and I think you see this a lot in the Falling Skies episodes, one of the things that I think is so apparent, but maybe to the trained eye, but maybe not so apparent to, you know, just the layman viewer, like the effects, you know, work really well within the context of the film. But you can also tell by looking at the way in which the effects are incorporated, either in the specific design of a given shot or even in the specific design of some characters, they are making creative choices that will also heighten their ability to increase the number of shots that they can accomplish over a given or a shorter schedule. So they're making really smart decisions about, you know, if they want to insert, say, a broken bridge into a scene to have it be in a shot where the camera's totally locked off, you know, the camera doesn't move, and they can create a really great looking matte painting that doesn't have any need for any kind of special tracking or shifts in parallax. Or when they do a character like in the Falling Skies, there's the character of the mechs, right? And one of the things I thought was interesting about the mechs is they're metallic, but they're sort of a brushed metal, so they don't actually have really hard reflections that have to be dealt with. They're somewhat diffuse. And I think that's, to me, something that, you know, maybe it's just a purely stylistic choice, but I can't help but look at that and think that there might also be a scheduling choice that's made there, too, where they want to make a great-looking effect, and they feel like they might be able to shave off a lot of time by limiting the high-definition, like an HDR reflection, you know, having to reflect back something really specific rather than something more diffuse.
Yeah, and other things even on a grander scale. So, for example, let's look at the last few episodes of Falling Skies in this context. And I think I'm going to get my numbering right, but the last three, let's call them 8, 9, and 10, you see an enormous conservation of visual effects in, I think, 8, where they basically have an episode that's going through the night as they're driving to Charleston. Mm-hmm. Hardly any visual effects shots, except for there must have been a ton of green screen keying and you know, grading stuff to do with like the car shots, but there wasn't character work. There wasn't big matte painting work. It was as if they said, okay, we're going to need to, you know, basically not stack this up with heavy, expensive visual effect shots. Now, I imagine that if you were doing it on pure shot count, that wouldn't show up. But in terms of production schedule, absolutely comping, you know, dark outside sort of vaguely moving road stuff is nowhere near as complex as having a fully motion-captured actor that's interacting with your live-action actors or extensive matte painting shots or whatever. And so those are the sort of decisions you have to make. And I've been in those production meetings where you go, look, our kind of rule of thumb is you have, you know, X amount of money or X amount of shots you can do. And they're like, well, we need for the season finale like twice that. Okay, well, we're going to have to go light in a couple of eps leading up to that. And that then leads into the writing because, it's really not the case that you would normally get that kind of a later scale production cycle flipping into the feature film writing process. You know, there's a budget and you sort of work out how to spend it. But you don't sort of say, okay, well, let's lighten off near the end of the third act because I need to save my crew because I'm not going to have time to get these shots done by the fourth act. Now, of course, you'd always balance budget, but actually balancing time to get those shots done and stuff, you really see that. And I was very conscious in watching. In fact, I was joking to my wife. I was like, oh, there must be a really big effect sequence coming because in the first 20 minutes of the last ep, we haven't had any visual effects. So they're going to have to be stacking it.
But
in
it
the
definitely
last...
builds up to multiple shots of Skidders and the Overlord and a big battle in that season two finale. So you're right, Mike, that it definitely builds up to something better and you end up seeing a lot of what I guess you say would be money shots on the screen in that final episode.
The other thing that you want to do is you want to reuse assets as much as you possibly can. So it's really great that you have a bunch of Skidders that are effectively the same model type. I could easily see background guys just being replicated without almost any changes. Now, yes, there are some hero guys, especially the one-eyed guy, but then, of course, that's the flip side of that same problem, isn't it? You have to do something. If you've got a character from that group that is actually meant to be an individual, you have to do something to them so the audience realizes that they are a different guy and a different character than the ones that are generally being populated. But yes, you try and reuse assets and rework stuff a lot. And that even comes down to extras. I think there was a scene where he was talking to the troops. I think it was right before they were reunited in Charleston, and he's on the back of a truck and he's giving a speech, and it really felt like they had four extras. I mean, it was just such an incredibly small group. And then, of course, in the next ep, they have millions of extras because they've arrived at Charleston. And it was almost like, yep, we can't afford any extras in this ep either. No visual effect shots. You're going to have to make do on a cramped, tight road. And why the lead up to a freeway would have such a tiny little road with trees on either side. But that's, you know, you can't see off. We don't want to be removing stuff from the background. We need to close in this shot, either have it inside trees, or at night because I can't afford to remove all the stuff. So anyway, let's swing to the specifics, and I'm going to start with you. And do you like the show? And what do you think of the actual kind of plot and story before we get into the visual effects per se?
I actually really like it. I one of the things I like the most, getting straight into the beginning, is how they sort of set up the whole series, which is 6 months into the invasion, you know, so you don't even have to see that. And that doesn't really need to be explained. Although I did like the way they did that in the first episode, which is a montage of children's drawings, saying how the aliens attacked and how they're putting the harnesses on them and what's happening to their families. But to me, that actually set up the series really well because you're already straight in there. You can sort of get to know the characters straight away without having sort of any kind of exposition. And, you know, in terms of the whole series, I sort of liked how each episode is standalone and they're each on little missions. And I've got to say, when I was watching Series 1, I was kind of wondering where they might go with it. But Series 2 then became a lot darker and you know, the characters' relationships became a lot more complicated. And also having this whole issue of a Skidder rebellion really added something to it as well. So it's kind of like the show kept surprising me, which TV series don't always do.
And you, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ian really summed it up well. I mean, I had not been watching this show. I remember hearing about it when it came about, and I immediately thought of a story that in the early or late 1970s, Steven Spielberg, who is involved as a producer on this project. I don't know how deeply involved he was in the development of the idea, but in the late 70s, he was working on a project which was kind of going to be not a direct sequel, but sort of a Close Encounters type of story called Night Skies, which originally was called Watch the Skies and eventually became Night Skies. And he had wanted to get Lawrence Kasdan to help him write this screenplay or a treatment for this idea, which was kind of a scary alien tale about these malicious ET type scientists who come to Earth and they try to communicate with chickens and cows and all this other livestock and stuff. And they were trying to discover which of Earth's species were sentient before they wind up turning their attention to this human family in the story. And so he eventually got John Sayles, who's also a great filmmaker in his own right, to develop a treatment for this idea with this alien character named Scar and this whole story and treatment. And they did this huge expensive makeup test with Rick Baker, where Rick Baker designed this character, a working prototype of this lead alien character. And in the end, it never really wound up getting off the ground. But one of the elements of the character in John Sayles' script was that he had this sort of grasshopper-like eyes and this beak of a mouth, and he killed farm animals by touching them with this long bony finger with an eerie kind of light at the end of it. And it eventually sort of morphed into this really fun, kind of sensitive, loving character in E.T., right, that came about later. But so I sort of felt like when I started reading about this that it felt like it was almost a TV version or a return to the idea of this Night Skies story that had never been produced. And I wasn't familiar with the series, but I sat down and I started watching the first couple episodes from the first season. And I totally hooked. And I mean, I haven't watched all of them, but I watched, I don't know, many hours of this in the last week and really enjoyed it. And I think you're totally right, Ian. I thought the first sequence, it felt pretty, it was compelling, but it felt a little bit formulaic. And the writing, I think, in the first season feels a little bit more simplistic, a little bit kind of clumsier. It's not, it feels very TV, right? And not like sort of, you know, HBO. It's not TV, it's HBO, right? It feels like television. But I do think that the second season, I think you're totally dead on. I had the same impression. Like, it felt like everything got upped. And I don't know if they got, you know, more money for the second season, like the budgets were bigger. Maybe they had different directors or different production designers, but everything felt beefed up in the second season. Even the music was more sophisticated. The interactions with the characters, the acting, maybe everybody kind of found their groove too. I don't know. But that second season, at least what I've seen so far, and I did watch the finale as well for the show, but I just feel like it's a much sharper show. And I like how it feels like they've really taken, sort of the Walking Dead and the Ronald Moore Battlestar Galactica, the sci-fi sort of reimagining of the series, which was infinitely better than the original. But it feels like they've taken those two series, Walking Dead and the Ronald Moore Battlestar Galactica, and they kind of merged those two together. So they kind of have this ragtag team on the road trying to get from place to place, and with all these various sort of incidents and missions that happen, people that fall by the wayside and are killed or kidnapped or harnessed or whatever. But then they also have this kind of real sci-fi element where there's some ships and some really pretty elaborate creatures and technology and stuff. And so, and there's the battle aspect of it too, where the Ronald Moore Battlestar Galactica really had played off this post 9/11 kind of, post-apocalyptic mindset of people being really sort of frightened and running, being sort of scared. And I think that this plays off of that to some extent too, maybe to slightly less success. I don't think the writing is quite of that caliber, but I do think it's a hell of a fun program on television, and there's very few good science fiction programs that come out. And so I really enjoyed what I've seen so far, and I'm going to go back and, you know, finish watching both the first and the rest of the second season.
The only criticism, I like the show. I started watching it. I think back at the beginning, it was the ugly stepchild to Supernova. Supernova was, you know, the one that had all the money, and it was also a Spielberg kind of thing. And this
You mean Terra Nova?
Terra Nova, sorry, yes. Yeah. And to an extent, it was, you know, we've seen this a couple of times. You get a show like 30 Rock that's in the shadow of studio, whatever it is, Aaron Sorkin's production, which has a lot more money, but then the big more money show doesn't make it and the underdog comes through and goes on to do 6, 8 seasons, whatever. And I felt this was an underdog when it came out. It was in the shadow of Terra Nova and it just sort of went along and did its stuff. I think it had two things really, really going for it. I think in terms of just, you know, watching the show, this has some really good actors in it. And, you know, Noah's Tom Mason is just really great. And so that's, you know, he's just a good actor.
We loved him from the air. Just as an aside, it's true, right, that if Sony and Aaron Sorkin go forward with their Steve Jobs movie, right, not the stupid Ashton Kutcher thing that we've read about, but doesn't Noah Wiley, he has to play Jobs, right? I mean, he's the spitting image of Steve Jobs, the same profile. I mean, that guy looks just...
Well, you saw the miniseries that he played him, right?
There's
a miniseries already where he played him.
Yeah, the Nerds of Silicon Valley or whatever it was called.
And he did a really good job. And in fact, I think he then turned up on stage at an Apple event as a joke to intro a keynote.
He did.
Just briefly. Yeah. But anyway, so I think that's good. Like, you need some solid actors because some of this stuff is absurd and some of it's silly. And if you don't have an actor that looks like they believe it, well, I'm sorry, you know, it's all over Red Rover. I think the second thing that they had going for them is that the show does have that kind of – in an episode, it does give you a conclusion, but overall there's an arc that makes sense and it's not a jump-the-sofa arc. It, you know, it does kind of play out. It's not completely improbable to be on the – you know, I mean, obviously it is improbable, but it's not sort of stupidly improbable and they don't you know, have people that are suddenly turn out to be robots and you're like, where did that come from? So I think that you get a satisfying episode each time and then you get like the plot moving along. I will say, though, I think, as I said at the outset, the criticism I have for it, I think in the second season they got perilously close to just being downright depressing. Around episodes, I think, 3 or 4 in the second series, there was almost like no hope. Every time they engaged with the enemy, they got out of it and they lost another guy and there seemed to be nowhere that this was going. And it wasn't until they suddenly, and they obviously had that plan, but we didn't know it as an audience, when they revealed the idea of the insurgents and suddenly there was some vague hope for something. Because I think you want an audience, as an audience, you want to be able to root for these guys a bit, not just I'm going to sit here and watch them die one by one over the weeks. That just doesn't make for, you know, no matter how much an individual episode is satisfying, it needs to be going somewhere. And so I think that was a brilliant plot line, which brings me to the end of the last ep, which is I think they've done another really good finale by producing an incredibly ambiguous and yet engaging final, well, it was almost final shot, wasn't it, of who the heck just landed and from where, and why was it that the skidders were helping to build a rocket to stop them, or a laser or whatever the heck it was to stop them. So, yeah, I think Battlestar Galactica got a little bit like close at some points to jumping the shark in that they started to get plot lines that were so incredibly weird and complicated, and people that killed people and then came back and it wasn't her, it was her another one. And,
right,
you know, it was like, by the end, I was like, this didn't feel as satisfying. This feels like we're going into series 3 with what could be a huge alien battle taking place on Earth with our guys kind of marginalized while the other two sort of duke it out, which in itself is an complete breath of fresh air to the show. And it didn't even feel stale going into it. So I definitely think series 3 could be even stronger than 2. And if that is the case, I certainly hope the audience keeps building. Does anyone know what the audiences were like at the end? I know that the end of series 1, they got spectacular viewership for the show. In fact, I think it opened with about 5.9 million viewers and it closed the series 1 at 5.6 million. So it was really good. But does anyone know how it finished out the second series? Did it hold its ratings to the end? Or?
I'm just looking now, and it didn't really, but it still had, it says here that I'm looking at, is a 3.8 million viewership at the end. So it does seem to have gone down a little, although they're not actually bad ratings. But compared to its initial ratings, it didn't seem to hold on to it. I'm not sure why that would be the case, because I agree with you, Mike. I think it actually got better. And actually, one thing I wanted to pick up on something you said when you sort of mentioned Terra Nova was that Falling Skies is so much darker. You know, obviously Terra Nova, I think, was really pitched at families. And one of the things I like about Falling Skies is that it's quite dark. I mean, they capture children and they put these harnesses on them, and there are a lot of sort of dark moments, which kind of works in its favor, you know, because otherwise you're sort of watching another Terra Nova or another family show.
And, yeah, I mean, you know, we've seen feature films with battle royales to kill children that have actually done rather well with... you're right, absolutely. Okay, so let's talk about the visual effects. I think that the Skidder character design is really good. I think it's actually stronger than the Overlord's character design, because the Overlord character design seems to me to be a design I've seen before. The Skidders are both really interesting, and because they're not a biped... just a phenomenal kind of character to deal with. It was very hard to be empathetic for them. I didn't sort of see it coming that they'd all sort of buddy up with them. So that can be sometimes a really horrible thing when the aliens actually turn out to be good guys after all, and it's all like lovey. But I actually thought these guys had such a insect-like persona that we didn't see them initially as anything but sort of killing machines, which was awesome, because then, you know, you get the same experience that the characters do, which is to then see them for more than just these evil killing machines. So, Matt, what do you think of character design?
Yeah, I actually think I would agree. I mean, it's almost like a, you know, like a crab centaur, right? That kind of design where they have this kind of seemingly humanoid sort of torso and upper body and arms to some degree, with a, you know, clearly defined head and eyes, but then there's this lower body that's really like a crab, you know, like some kind of sidewinder beach crab or something, and the animation and the movement of those characters, and then really their scale too, I think, is really satisfying. They're sort of on par with a human, but then a little bit bigger, because they have a much larger kind of platform upon which they move. And I think that, yeah, the design overall is really great. It's something that, you know, you don't get to see much on TV, and they haven't shied away from showing it really in great detail as well. I mean, you see it oftentimes in shots, you know, full body, you know, full blown. And in this last episode, the season 2 finale, there's a sequence where you see all these guys standing really in, not daylight, but in really bright interior lighting. And, I mean, they really just kind of go for it. And they're like, all right, here it is, you know, check it out. Like, and there's no need to be, you know, to avert your eyes. You really get a good look at it. And I think for the most part, those composites and stuff work fairly well. There are times where, though, some of the comps look a little tough, and I didn't really get a chance to or have the time to parse through the shots in any really specific way. But, you know, things that popped to mind was, I know that this is shot, I believe, on film, right? The show is actually shot on 35mm. Is that correct?
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah, and so part of me thought maybe, you know, is the grain not matching in some shots, or is in terms of the comp, or is it possible that maybe where black levels don't match? And I was curious if you guys had any issue with any of the comps of any of the Skidder characters in shots, or if it was just my viewing experience.
I didn't have comp problems with the Skidders. I had major comp problems with this episode 8, the one at night, when they were driving, because the black levels didn't match. Now, it may have matched on someone's monitor, but on mine, there was definitely the interior. I mean, it's a heck of a problem, because you want to light up characters that are meant to be completely dark inside a car, and then you have black outside, and somebody thought, oh, okay, well, it'll be lighter inside than outside, so we'll make outside black. The trouble is, the black level, in other words, the darkest point of black on the inside, was still a grey level above the darkest, or even the sort of average darkness outside the window. And so you got that comp look where that black, if you just crushed the interior or lifted the exterior to match, you would have sold the shots, because the keys weren't too bad, but the black levels were out. So in the car, especially the Tom's son and her girlfriend who was confessing that she'd been a junkie with a baby. During that sequence, I was really stunned. I thought the camera work was kind of interesting because they, instead of putting the right side character on the right side of screen and the left character on the left side of screen, they actually framed the shot so the person on the right of the car, the woman, actually sat on her screen right, though facing the correct way, in terms of it wasn't crossing the line, and the guy who's driving, who should have been on a normal shot, you know, to the right of frame, was on the left of frame with more exterior car. So nice framing, I thought. Nice kind of, you know, general dealing with the problem. The lighting wasn't particularly odd, though it is, as I say, a ridiculous problem to try and solve with no ambient light. You know, why are they so lit up? But the black level didn't match. That would be my comp criticism. And then the other one for me is I don't think the mix, they're moving robotically, I know that, but they feel like they're lacking enough motion blur in many of the walking sequences, even though they are mechanical. They feel very much lacking the same level of quality in terms of realism that I'm seeing out of the skidders. I actually think the skidders are remarkably well achieved, and I think helped in enormous part by the quality of the what must be maquette or animatronics or puppets, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too. That it seems the way they've filmed a lot of the skidder scenes was that they had a master's effects maquette or animatronic, you know, for a hero shot. And then when they needed to fill out other skidders around, those were CG. But they also added, obviously, the limbs and the legs because that couldn't be something done practically. But as long as you're sort of starting with something practical, it seems like that gave a better result to everything else that's in the shot.
I mean, I'll give you an example. The scene that I thought was just really good work all round is the one-eyed guy goes in to meet the head of the military I think it's at the beginning of episode 10 or it could be in episode 9, I guess. It must be episode 9. Anyway, so there's a scene where the one-eyed guy is appearing for the first time. Tom's son comes in and Tom's son acts as translator and they discuss this whole premise of there's an opportunity to get the Overlord. You guys know the shot I'm talking about? Like it's in a room, four, five, six actors standing around the one skidder. Okay. Not only was that really well executed in terms of here we had to get some empathy for this character, believability, and it wasn't actually talking. It couldn't do a lot of facial stuff on it. So I thought that was really nice. I thought it was well puppeteered. The eye lines all worked. But there were just lots of subtle things that someone did that loved that shot. When the scudder's leaving the room, so it's a nothing shot. He's walking out of the room, a couple of guards behind him. You know, the scudder's walking and you see his arm go up and grab the door and just use the door to kind of get through the door because it's a multi-limbed beast as it can climb walls and as it, you know, is not sort of destined to just go on the ground the whole time. It just as validly pulls itself through the door using a right camera right, I'm going to call it an arm. It reaches up, grabs the sort of side of the door frame and sort of pulls itself through as much as it walks through. And I thought, well, that's a good track. It's convincingly comped. And it's just nice character work, you know. It's like somebody gave attention to how that thing would move. It has a well thought out back character. So I thought the scudders. But I mean, I'm a long way around your question about the comp, Matt. But I thought the scudders were some of the best executed stuff.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the mechs earlier, and some of the sort of lack of maybe believability of some of the elements of the mech. I don't know if you are referring specifically to design or what, but one of the things about the mechs that I found problematic is I think oftentimes they don't look like they almost look like they're, I know they have lights on them, but they almost look like the main sort of head part of the dome in shots at night. They almost look like they're luminescent rather than metallic, like
they're overlit.
The lighting on the mechs oftentimes doesn't feel in the night shots to me, and the bulk of them. I mean, it's something that I can, in the episodes that I watched, I felt like it was something that was sort of consistent throughout. And maybe there's some reason behind it that I don't understand, but it made them look like they weren't really in the scene in a way that I felt like they could have had they had more dramatic lighting on them, where they oftentimes they felt like they were almost you know, they had their own light source rather than being, you know, shadowed correctly in the scenario.
I think I agree with you, Matt. Occasionally in some of the scenes, they have a more of an orange light on them rather than what might be reflected from a metallic surface, which, you know, can be could be quite dramatic depending on where they were. I didn't have a huge problem with them except when there was, say, five in the scene, because when they were walking, I really felt like that's where you could tell there was a bit of a generic walk cycle attached to them, and they really did look the same, which they do. You know, they pretty much are just the same mechanical construction. But I thought when there was more than one in the scene, you could really tell that, you know, the same sort of animation cycle was applied to them.
The scene that I totally agree with you over, Matt, is I think it's going to be ep 6 or 7 when they, they're pinned down at the hospital. And one of their own is out on patrol, and he's trying to walk back to the barricade, and the mech's up behind him, and the mech shoots the guy cold dead while they're holding onto the Overlord inside in the psych ward. And in those shots, you should absolutely have not seen the mech lit up that much, because it had basically spotlights at camera. The contrast ratio, yeah, was way out. So you would basically sort of get a much more rim-lit, backlit, dramatic kind of, or almost unable to be seen. I mean, who hasn't been, you know, a car is approaching? How much do you see the car with the headlights? I mean, you just don't.
Yeah. Well, it made me wonder, too, like, there's another scene involving a number of mechs that takes place in a, I don't remember if it's the first or second season now, but it was one of the episodes I was skimming through, and I was kind of looking for particular effect shots. And there's one sequence where it looked like they're in sort of a suburban neighborhood, and there's, it's a daylight scene, and I think like five or six mechs walk up to where they have this barricade, and it's, I think it's in the suburbs, or maybe it was at the hospital now, I don't quite remember exactly, but it's a daylight scene of about five or six of them. They all kind of walk up together, and they kind of line up in this one spot, and the, and again, it was, to me, it felt like it was a lighting issue, and I couldn't help but wonder, and maybe you know this, Mike, I don't know, you know, on a TV show like this where, you know, as you were saying earlier, like they're making a concerted effort to maximize their bang for the buck, so to speak, right? So they're not going to have as many effects in, you know, certain scenes or in certain episodes. They're going to try to repurpose as many things as they can. Does, in a show like this, would you think that the effects supervisor or the effects house that's the lead, in this case, Zoic, I mean, are they able to have, obviously they have people going on set, but are they able to get up in some of these setups and shoot like HDRs and stuff and get like key lighting reference, you know, on the day
so
they've got stuff when they go back? Like, you know, is that kind of time allotted?
Yeah, they have to, actually, because the basic workflow that Zoic uses on this, and we know this from an article that was published, they do use IBL or image-based lighting to set stuff up, and then they tweak it after that. And in fact, it's faster to do probes and feed that into your lighting pipeline and then tweak it than it is just to light the whole thing from scratch.
Yeah.
I'm going to say the other thing that I wanted to flag, because I flagged it in a previous episode and it was just so apparent in this one. I think it was last week's episode we were talking about Bourne Identity and or Bourne, whatever it was, Bourne 4. And he climbs the side of a building and we were discussing the problems of that in terms of weight. And this was absolutely shown when the, the girl climbs the inside of the rocket silo thing.
Yeah, the girl that climbs up at the end, the blonde girl. Yeah, that was so egregious.
It was horrendous. And it was horrendous not because it was badly comp, not because it was bad wire removal. It's just because these rigs that are lifting by the waist, you end up having someone that's just basically doing the climbing equivalent of breaststroke. And the climbing equivalent of breaststroke in the sense that you would film someone on dry land on a box doing breaststroke and then try and pump them into water and make you believe they were swimming through it. The physics is just out. The believability is out. The she's either got a rocket up her butt or she's got a wire pulling her up. But there's no way those limbs.
Yeah, I mean, I think that shot in particular was just so blatantly bad. Like, it was comical because it made me think exactly the same thing, Mike. I thought of our conversation about Bourne Legacy and about, you know, sort of the, you know, his super climbing ability and how, you know, I had sort of felt in Bourne Legacy that they did a good job of cutting around it, but I had seen that B-roll, you know, on set footage prior to the film. And I remember thinking that B-roll footage, I was like, oh man, I hope it doesn't look like that in the movie. And this clip of this girl climbing this wall at the end in the alien structure, it really was, it was the B-roll, you know? I mean, it was really funny.
Okay, but I want to go into, so it's easy to pick holes and stuff in when you've got this much work episodic. I want to also compliment them on some outstanding work. I'm going to go earlier in series two. There is a scene when they are a series of events that lead them to discover a head on the other side of a fallen bridge, the bridge that they have to cross, the only bridge that can get across a river. I think it's some kind of antenna outpost, whatever. It's a large structure in the forest. And at this point, everybody's trying to get across the bridge. They're going to put down stuff to get across this bridge because one of the flybys has blown a hole in it. There's a lot of drama of whether they can get over the bridge or not and whether they're going to be trapped and pinned at this bridge. But at night, on a reconnaissance mission, they discover this base, which has got where the guys are flying from, and they have to go blow it up. Now, I thought the combination of digital and matte painting that went into creating that structure, the economy of use of not trying to, you know, they obviously were going to use it for one ep and one ep only. So they couldn't get in close. They couldn't do a whole lot of work on it in terms of having it be seen from every different angle or having a ship fly into it or a point of view shot that panned around it. It had to be pretty much an over there structure. But then they had to have a couple of guys run down and put explosives on it and set it off. And I thought, you know, there is a case that it could have looked hokey and it could have looked unbelievable, but the structure looked unique, looked believable. It was lit up at night. It sat into the environment. It was a brilliant use of episodic effects. It gave enough of a plot point. They obviously didn't blow all their budget on it. They had some coming and going, some lights flashing, some interaction, and then they just cut around it. The editing work to not have to reveal it too much from too many odd angles, the design of it being, you know, down an embankment so they could shoot camera angles of people sort of scurrying down the hill to the base of it without expecting to look up and see it, because clearly if you're going down a bank and you've got a very tall thing, you're not going to see it in that shot. It was just skillfully executed at every level. Now, is it mega feature film Transformers level? Well, no, it obviously isn't. But that's not the point. I think the point is to execute something like that that serves the plot, gives you some production value, and doesn't wipe you out for the budget. And that one episode had, you know, skitters and mechs coming, attacking them at the bridge. It had effect sequences of the bridge being blown up. It obviously had some matte painting work done. Just thought it was really nicely executed. And it wasn't a lead ep 1 and it wasn't an end ep 10. So it clearly wasn't, you know, one where they'd been saving their bullets and saving their powder to mount it. Ian, do you know what I'm talking about, the ep?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I really agree with you. And one of the things I was going to mention was that apart from the creatures that Zoic had to create, they've really done an awesome job, I think, in the environments and also, you know, glimpses of spaceships and that massive structure right in the first series as well.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about it earlier with episodic television, both Zoic and Stargate really push their virtual backlot capabilities. And I think, you know, here you can really see it, even if it is in the distance and actually never at the forefront of some of the shots, that's actually what makes them more convincing for me. And you mentioned, Mike, that really they had to do this just for one episode, and it's obviously a lot of work, but I think that's what makes the shots more convincing, that, you know, you don't really see them at the forefront.
Yeah, and I would really agree, too. I mean, when you started mentioning that one, the smaller structure in that one episode, I immediately thought of what you just mentioned, Ian, which was that large kind of weird tripod with a giant T on top of it or whatever structure in the first season. And I think that, you know, that really reminded me a lot of, you know, some of the really cool effects that I always really enjoy are these big kind of vista matte painting type effects. And you see them in feature films. Like if you go back and remember in the movie, the Zemeckis film, I think it was Contact, right? And they built that huge structure, and you would see that structure in the distance, you know, the whatever that thing was called, the weird warping time-space thing. And then, you know, even in more recently in District 9, you know, the big ship that was kind of always in the distance that you would see in the background really had that same kind of look and feel as the structure that was being built or that was one of these alien structures over the city, I guess, of Boston, right, in the first season. And that kind of stuff is just, it adds so much production value. And, you know, the Zoic just did such a, you know, knock it out of the park job on the look of that thing. Like, it just really, it sat in the environment really well. It never, it was comp perfectly. It wasn't always the center of attention, but it added so much believability to the events that were taking place sort of in the foreground to have that kind of detail.
Yeah, there was another really good use of matte paintings. Man, I wish I had noted the episode. It was in the middle of the series of two, and Hal, I think Hal's the eldest son, isn't it? So Hal and his girlfriend are looking over at a bombed out city, basically. And in a little bit, there'll be an explosion over there. But basically, it's just a nice matte painting. She's sitting, looking there. He comes up and finds her. And we know, you know, some of the line about, you always come here first thing in the morning. And it was, it was just a classic matte painting. And, you know, as much as we may be dismissive of them in a classic VFX sense, well, it's obviously a matte painting kind of ... Who cares? It's a, you know, it's a nice big shot. When you had the shot of Charleston in episodes, say, I'm going to say 8, they come to the end of the bridge. You have the shot of them at the broken off bridge. It doesn't go anywhere. And the reverse shot of the destroyed city of Charleston. Like, the audience needs some big wide shots. You can survive with close-ups as long as you've got the big wide establishing shot. And okay, yes, we don't fly through it. No, yes, we don't. You know, it isn't a 3D model. We can pretty much tell that. I don't think it matters. I think you can get a lot of production value out of a really good matte painting.
Absolutely. And they're so economic. I mean, it makes me think of, you know, I think it was, is it Gareth Edwards, right? In his movie Monsters, there's that great shot similar to the ones that we're describing. There's that great shot that's, again, just gives so much production value for really, you know, maybe not quite as much work as many of the other shots, where I think they're on top of one of these pyramids, right? And they see the wall that separates Mexico from the United States, and the wall kind of just goes all the way across, and it's just a big, you know, essentially just a big map painting in the distance, but it works so great.
I don't think okay, here's like, there's the three groups of people that are watching. There's effects artists like us, okay, so obviously we know how it's done, but then we know how everything's done, right? So, like, we're smart asses, and who cares, right? I mean, seriously, like,
it's true.
And then there's no, but to a certain point, from a showrunner's point of view, he's not making the show for to please the VFX show. We're trying to do this show to, you know, highlight the work that's done by people, but, you know, like, that's not who you're making the show for. Okay, then there are two other significant groups. There are those that would be, I'm going to describe them as almost fanboys, but I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I mean, it's a group that is really passionate about the show and is likely to know that it's a matte painting because they love making ofs and they watch that kind of stuff. They're not in the industry, but they understand it. Well, you're not going to turn that group away by having a really good, impressive wide shot. They, even if they know it's a matte painting, they love the show. They love the stuff. And as long as that's not the only thing that's in there, they're going to love it to death. And then there's everybody else. And for everybody else, they don't care. They just think it's a good shot.
Yeah, so, and they're just involved in the story. And that element adds so much to the believability of the story, to the context, to the larger understanding of the world. I mean, it, you know, it works. Like, it just doesn't – it just works. Like, it's not I think it's a, you know, a non – It's something that when you do it and you put it in a show and it works like that, it sells itself. Like, it, you know, it adds more than it could ever detract, even though it is, as you say, just a matte painting. Like, they look good.
Well, see, the thing is, I've got...
And don't you think they've also done a good job in terms of the structure of the show, you know, with the two real cliffhangers, with Tom going into the ship at the end of Series 1 and now with this new alien creature at the end of Series 2? I kind of think that's sort of almost like old-school TV with those cliffhangers.
They do, but just before I get to that, I want to make one more point about that I was heading towards on this idea of the three groups. My problem is there is a trend over the last 5-10 years of a director saying, I want to do a shot, so people will say, how'd they do that? And I wasn't aware of this at the time when I first started hearing it, because I was, oh, yeah, let's do something that's like really impossible. People won't know how they've done it. And I've done those shots, right, where the camera has moved impossibly in a live-action plate, and because I've stitched three things together, and I've been really proud of that fact. But it started to dawn on me in the last few years that you can end up with gratuitous effect shots simply because you're trying to pull off a shot so that people will go, oh, my God, how did they do that? But I don't think the how did they do that-ness is such a driving force now, because in my scenario of the three groups, that third group, I honestly believe, would think a 3D model of Charleston and a matte painting of Charleston is just both effects, and they would give them equal weight. So I don't think that if you were to come up with an amazing flyover shot, as that obviously required a 3D model of Charleston, versus the impressive matte painting shot, as long as there's good acting involved, I don't think that people now are in the zone of just thinking, oh, how'd they do that? They're all like, yeah, it's all done on the computer. And so because they almost reduce it to it's all done on the computer, it's just assumed to be either a good effect or a bad effect, but just an effect. And you could work incredibly hard to come up with the impossible shot. And sometimes you might even argue that they're really effective. That one of Tom Cruise in War of the Worlds, where it starts on him in the car as he's driving, goes out the window, around the car, and back in the other window again. But also you can end up with obscurely non-narrative justified shots simply so that you can almost show off and say, hey, see, there's no way you can work out how we did this. And I think that only now caters to the first group. That would be us. We would be like, how the hell did they do that? But almost every other group would be, okay, it's effects. You did it in the computer. And you go, yeah, but don't you see? How would you do that? And they'd be like, I don't know. You do it on the computer, right? Like, you're getting my point? Like, they're almost completely dismissive. And so there is less of this awe of how did they do it, because they assume anything can be done in the computer. They read articles every day that say anything can be done in the computer. So clearly anything can be done. Sorry, Ian, get back to your point. You were talking about the narrative structure in terms of cliffhangers.
Well, I just thought that works both for the end of Series 1 and Series 2, and maybe we should talk about that final alien creature at the end. And one of the things I really liked most about it was, did you notice one of the characters... With television, I think sometimes they're always are trying to show you things that you haven't seen before, whether it's a dramatic shot, as you're mentioning, Mike, but also with creatures and sort of characters. And it's funny that one of the characters, actors, actually says as it comes out of the spaceship, it's something we've never seen before. And I almost thought that was a bit of a tongue-in-cheek play at what does happen in films and some TV shows where they're really trying to push it to the next level. But here, you know, it's an absolutely convincing character, and I was sort of on the edge of my seat seeing what was going to come out of this rocket, you know, because A, it's a cool, funky way that the rocket comes down in front of them, and B, you kind of really don't know what it is, and then its helmet, you know, opens up, and even then, they're not sort of shooting at the character, and obviously it goes straight to black. And there's even that little post note at the end of the show, which is it an ally or foe? So I just like that. Really, now I just can't wait for Series 3, and not all television does that for me.
The only thing I would say is I think the staging and the direction let that sequence down, because you've got a group of people that are pent up, worried about attack. Suddenly it sounds like they're under attack. What's the first thing everyone's going to do? Everyone as a group is going to run out and stand in a contained area where there's no escape with no cover in a large group and point towards something that could open fire and just wipe them all out in one laser sweep. I mean, it was like on a group that's trained to duck and cover, it was like, hey, let's hoard. And it just felt to me like someone said, what are we doing for this shot? And we got all these extras because we paid for them. Everybody runs out, so it's really big and dramatic. But the shot reversing, so the shot, the live action shots of them, just seem so a notch down in sort of sophistication than the reverse shot, which I agree, the actual visual effects, cracker.
I think you know, that's a really specific example, but I do think, you know, it's one of the sort of suspension of disbelief things that you kind of have to engage in with, you know, an episodic television show of this nature that, at least in the United States, is being broadcast, you know, on a fairly you know, I would argue risk-averse network where they don't really do too many, like, hardcore cutting-edge programs. But I think that what's interesting about it is that you do see that happen frequently. Like, one of the things in that final episode, and they do this throughout the two seasons that just sort of, on a narrative level, kind of made me crazy, was that in this final episode, like, who is that idiot, you know, Max Headroom general guy, right? Matt Feuer, or whatever his name is, who was the Max Headroom who plays the head general, that he's the most incompetent military trainee and leader of all time. Like, it's completely unbelievable that somebody would have that level of, cowardice and, operational foolhardiness, where he would, like, sort of be playing these two characters against one another. Like, it's the antithesis of the kind of things that, you know, you're taught in, officer training school or whatever in the military. Like, you know, that you would never question yourself, or that you wouldn't seek other people in the military who would, you know, question your decision making. Like, you know, that's kind of the first rule of leadership, right? The second you stop having people ask you questions as to whether or not you're making the right decision, when all you surround yourself with is, you know, yes men or whatever, that, you know, you kind of lose your ability to have any real perspective. And I just found some of those things are totally unbelievable, but you kind of have to go there, right? You have to go there with the story in order for it to be executed. Like, there might be some other narrative arc that they could take to execute it, or in that closing shot, you know, they could have maybe structured, you know, sort of the staging of it in such a way that it would be a little bit more believable. But at the same time, too, I think it's those three audiences that you sort of mentioned. Like, you know, a really savvy filmmaking audience is going to be, you know, critical of some of those story elements or some of those stagings. But, you know, the average mom and pop watching the show, or, you know, young teenage kids or whoever, it's sort of, you know, are gravitating towards this, like, they're not going to care. And in the end, they're just like, oh, that was awesome, you know?
Yeah, I shouldn't be too harsh on that end sequence, because I did think the character looked interesting. I liked the reveal from the helmet. That gave us a second, like, who's going to be under the helmet? You know, what's going on? So, yeah, you know, I totally liked it. But, yeah, it's difficult when the effects – in that case, the effects were so good that now the constraints of episodic television, you know, sort of became apparent. I mean – obviously, you can't do feature film on an episodic budget and on the schedule and on everything else. I mean, you just can't do it, right? It's just no possible way. But I don't know. I just felt that they really delivered with those, as almost like parachute drop ships coming down, and the alien stepping out was really interesting. And I think it did succeed in setting it up really well for the third series. So I just wanted it a little less hokey. And yeah, I mean, obviously, some of the character stuff, you know, is. And to an extent, the dialogue. But yeah, it's a good show, and I think we should get behind it. I think also, quite frankly, there's way, way more good in this show than bad.
I agree.
And So when we pick at stuff, we're trying to not just be nasty. We're trying to say what we think works and what doesn't work. But I think, you know, the part of it is a curiosity in being able to understand how they've succeeded in pulling off some of the problems that they have. You know, I mean, if you're going to economize on shots, how do you do that? Well, I think it was a good solution. Having them drive at night, you know, it was a different change of pace. There are lots of things like that, you know, if you're going to have a character that's sick and you can't move them and you don't have enough fuel, that's a great reason to stay where you are. You know, you're going to have to come up with devices, and their devices are as good as any, if not in some cases better. So I think if you don't know the show that well, you should totally spend more time with it. I also think that the artists involved, as I think Ewan said, lifted in series two, and I'm full of optimism for what they're going to pull off in series three. But I do think we should do a couple of factual things now, because I don't think we've sort of adequately given credit to those involved. So, Ian, can you give us the rundown on those physical, I think you mentioned before who was doing them, but the actual physical versions of the scudders, because they are key to this show working, and we should give practical effects the credit they deserve.
Yeah, well, the practical on-set skidders is the result of work by Masters Effects, and that's Todd Masters' company. And as we were saying, it's kind of great that they have that there and is actually in the final shots. I mean, sometimes you do put the practical things and use them for on-set interaction, but and then replace them with CG. And no doubt that does happen. But here you can really, I mean, I think I can tell that a lot of it is practical, and but it works, you know, it works in the shot. So they're great. And obviously Zoic are doing an awesome job in adding in Skitters. And they also did, I don't think we talked about it yet, the Overlord character as a motion capture character. That's the tall, skinny, skinny ones, which I actually think worked. You didn't think the design was that good, Mike, you were mentioning before?
It was not so much that it was bad, because I like especially the stuff that's going around with the neck and the way that it's done. And I like it, the fish heads, as they're jokingly referred to. But it didn't seem, especially the dimensions and this kind of long, lanky thing, it felt slightly more derivative. And the only reason I say that was to praise the Skitter design. Do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't disappointment in them so much as it was to highlight how well they'd done in coming up with an original design for a character, and a character that I would not immediately expect to empathize with, and suddenly, through good acting and good visual effects, come to actually kind of like. I mean, I was sad when the one-eyed guy died at the last step.
I would say that the first thing I thought of when I saw the Overlord character was the tall, skinny aliens in AI.
Exactly.
They don't really look the same, but it's that skinny nature of the long arms and limbs that made me think of that immediately.
Yeah, and I don't, as I say, dislike the implementation of them, or even in any way think that they're badly animated and that they don't serve their purpose, because they do. But it's a character design that we have seen a little.
Yeah, it felt, Matt, it just felt more familiar. I think I would agree. Yeah. Like, as a design aesthetic, it reminded me too of the characters who are building the clones in the Star Wars, you know, with the long neck and the very elongated body. And I think, that AI reference is really great. I mean, and it just, I don't think they're poorly done at all. I mean, I think they're actually really well done. And it's always interesting to see them in the scene. The design, the second I saw it, I was like, oh, that's it. It just felt familiar in a way that the Skitter characters don't, I think.
Now, can I pivot, and I mean, this is virtually an ad, so I apologize to you, except for if you're listening to this show, you might find it phenomenally interesting, because I do. The other thing that this show has a lot of is practical effects in terms of explosions and, things flying through the air that look like missiles or whatever they are, but there's a lot of prac explosions and stuff. And I think the guys that are on set that are doing that are really, really good. But I just wanted to, if I could, for a second, just flag the fact that at FXPHD, we're actually doing an entire practical course on visual effects and combining them, practical effects with digital, that's happening at the old ILM sound stages, which is now 3210 in San Francisco. So I apologize for the ad, but I do think it's kind of fun. It's beyond fun, actually. I think it's going to be really awesome. We have a three-day workshop happening at the end of September. So it's the last 2 days of September, the first day of October. You can get information on it at FX Guide or if at FX PhD. But it's basically a practical effects and digital integration workshop. 3210 is basically the rebuilding of Kerner. And Kerner was what happened after the split of ILM. So these are the guys from the original ILM workshop. The company is now called 3210. And this three-day workshop we're doing with them includes an amazing array of guys, especially Marty Rosenberg, who's a very, very well-known effects DOP, but also Jeff Heron and Vince Sequatro and Sean House. And the thing about these guys is some of them, like Vince, come from a digital background. So they did digital models, etc. And some of the guys, have been doing physical and prop-type stuff on Avengers most recently kind of thing. So it's a really great mix of those two. And then add to that mix, we've got Scott Squires, ex-ILM, but obviously 3 times Oscar nominee, and Scott's coming in. Now, Scott actually started his career way back in the day when they were doing early things like cloud tanks on Close Encounters. So we're trying to put together an actual cloud tank. I don't think anyone's done a big cloud tank recently, but we're going to try and do a big cloud tank and just kind of an homage to the old school and also a link forward. And the other reason I mention this is if you're listening to the show we did with Mark Christensen where he was talking about Cinefex and he's doing the back issues, and Mark's obviously a regular contributor to this show. Well, Mark's going to be there as well, and we're going to do a tie-in. We've got a tie-in happening with the Cinefex with Don Shea and the guys, and we're going to be referencing some of the old issues of Cinefex and how they did stuff. So it's going to be that, but then you add into that, we're going to be doing a lot of high-speed photography, shooting on Phantoms and Epics, and a lot of cutting-edge how this stuff should be shot and keyed and lighting green screens and digital compositing and workflow issues that come out of being on set like this. There's only a very small number of places, and as we record this, I think 3/4 of them are already sold. So if you're listening to this and you want to come, I can't make any promises that there'll be any places left, but it's $18.50. The information's available on our website. I just want to flag it because if you listen to this show, obviously you're interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that just sounds so cool. I mean, I love that location, too. I mean, when I that's where ILM was located the whole time I worked for the company. It was long before they moved to the city. And, you know, so many just amazingly fun, fascinating, crazy things happened at that location where, you know, on the movie Always, you know, they basically lit the interior of the stage almost on fire, you know, to create these great shots of some of the aircraft flying through these forest environments. And the crash from the movie Alive was shot on the back lot there. Bill George, I think, was the visual effects supervisor. And to get a chance to go and see all these guys, you know, and to do some of these practical effects, to learn how to make some things that you could maybe integrate into shots of your own that you're working on for your own project. But also, too, to get a chance to sit down and talk with and hear from Scott Squires, who is, you know, just a total luminary in the industry. I mean, he's been around for a long time and is just the nicest guy you could ever want to meet. And such a wealth of knowledge. And he also co-wrote the with a couple other cats, the Visual Effects Society, the Visual Effects Handbook. So Scott had a big hand in the writing of that as well. But that just sounds like it's going to be awesome.
Oh, yeah. And Scott, of course, wrote Commotion. So he was forefront of actually coding digital tools.
Yeah, Puffin software.
And most recently, he did the stereo conversion, or was part of the stereo, you know, he worked out the stereo conversion pipeline on Transformers. So he has that perspective as well, like shooting these elements, how would I use them if I was going to stereo convert them and stuff. And yeah, that's just, I mean, I just couldn't think of anything more fun than hanging out on set for 3 days at the old ILM studios, blowing stuff up, talking to these guys, learning from them. And understanding the issues. This isn't miniatures. I should be clear about this. We have done a miniatures one like this. So that was about 5 years ago. We did a miniatures only thing with large motion control rigs. This is all effects. This is all earth, wind, and fire, explosions, water, you know, just fun stuff. And here's the other kicker. You will actually get to take away, if you're at the event, a set of original RAW files and actual camera takes that you can have to use that are yours. We just... you can't resell them, but apart from that, you can use them in productions, you can use them commercially, you can do whatever you want. And that alone would be pretty cool, shooting at like 600, awesome. 800 frames, whatever. Yeah.
That is very cool.
Lots of fun. Anyway, that's the AFX PhD Live. Well, that's it for this week. I want to thank you guys so much for being on the show. Matt, do you want to tell people where you're at and where they can sort of contact you?
Yeah, I was going to also give a shout out to Scott Squires. Has a great blog website. It's effectscorner.blogspot.com, and Scott really does a lot of great stuff too, talking about a lot of the kind of the labor issues and stuff, I think, that are sort of a part of the conversation in the visual effects community right now as well, and something worth checking out. And also Scott is on Twitter too, and he's a great guy to follow. But you can always find me on Twitter at Matt Wallen, or on my website at mattwallen.com.
And that's particularly relevant as we are recording this, having just seen DD default on some of their loans and share go into freefall.
We
don't know what the
Matt
outcome of that will be. But we
close and didn't fuel and visual effects close as well.
Yep. So we're saddened by those events, and we don't know what will happen with DD. But obviously, I have one of my best friends in the world working there, being Jeff. So we certainly hope that they find a way to restructure and sort stuff out. And Ian, you have your own blog and as well as Twitter handle. What are you?
Oh, well, the blog is vfxblog.com, and my Twitter handle is also vfxblog, but you can find me just at FX Guide. Lots of articles there. And the only other thing I wanted to add about Falling Skies is that one of the producers and writers of the show is Graham Yost, who wrote Speed I really had to add that in there.
Okay, so for those of you that don't understand the joke, my good friend Ian is somewhat obsessed by the film Speed. Now, you might think that I'm exaggerating this or that that means that he's watched the film more than once, but I would actually say that he has an unrivaled collection of Speed memorabilia and has actually had a museum exhibition of Speed memorabilia from his personal collection. And as I'm speaking, his office, I know, has blow-up Speed dolls and a brilliant collection of Speed posters from around the world. And if anyone actually is sitting on any, you know, old truck tyres that they picked up off the set of Speed, Ian is always in the business of buying such things, and, you know, you could really make a fortune by avoiding eBay and going straight to Ian. Thanks for that, Ian. Thank you guys for listening. Obviously, I'm Mike Seymour, but hey, check out that FX PhD Live stuff. It'll be awesome. And of course, one of the main reasons we're doing this is that we'll be using footage from this in next term's, the October term of FX PhD, which looks like it will be by far one of the biggest terms we've ever had, and not just because of this practical stuff. Okay, well, thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. And again, congratulations to the teams involved in that. And we will be following this also as these episodic programs obviously go into the Emmys. So everyone who's even been nominated, I just have one piece of advice. If you're at the Emmys, avoid spending a lot of time at the ice sculpture tequila volcano where the Patron is drizzling out of the volcano all night, because after 6 hours of that, when you get in the limo, it can be a little harsh. And that's it for this week. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.